Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Eileen Charles. It's the Ides of March, so with a nefarious nod to Caesar, we've got murder on our minds. This week's literary crime spree spans England, Ireland, France, Denmark, and our own turbulent shores. Which country's criminals and cops will nab you with their capers? Worth investigating. And I'm certain you'll enjoy the brilliant diversity in writing styles and tempos. My guest today, Valerie Plame, is a former covert CIA operations officer who, you may remember, has been in the headlines from 2003 on. Her thriller, Burned, turns up the heat with international terror at its core. So, ready to sample from this international smorgasbord of murder and mystery? Let's turn to page one of the book report. Charles Todd takes readers into Detective Ian Rutledge's past to his final case before the outbreak of World War I. On a fine summer's day, begins in June 1914. Ian Rutledge pays little notice to the assassination of an archduke in Sarajevo. An inspector at Scotland Yard, Rutledge is planning to propose to the woman he loves, despite intimations from friends and family that she may not be the wisest choice. In another part of the country, a son awaits the undertaker in the wake of his widowed mother's death. This death will set off a series of murders across England, seemingly unconnected, that Rutledge will race to solve in the weeks before the fateful declaration in August that transforms the world. As the clouds of war gather on the horizon, all of Britain wonders and waits. With every moment at stake, Rutledge sets out to right a wrong, an odyssey that will force him to choose between the Yard and his country, between love and his duty. Stephen Crossley narrates.
Jean could have been overawed by the attentions of Ian's formidable elderly family connection. And so Melinda had drawn up a list of young people, arranged for caterers and a small orchestra for Saturday evening, and then invited Ian first to be absolutely certain he could come down. And the more time she'd spent in Miss Gordon's company, the more she dreaded the thought that Ian might marry her. Melinda, old enough to be Ian Rutledge's grandmother, had been friends with his parents before he was born. And of all the young people she was close to, this was the one she loved the most. Frances, attractive and bright, had inherited her mother's grace and steadiness. She would do very well. And Ross, too, in the end, whatever was worrying him at the moment. Melinda's young cousin Bess had her mother's spirit and her father's clear mind. There was nothing to worry about there. She'd been invited for the weekend as well, of course, but she and her parents were in the south of France, visiting with friends from India. In spite of her careful planning, the weekend had not gone precisely as Melinda Crawford had expected. Jean had seized the chance to spend more time in Ian's company, and rather than sharing him with the other guests, she had often contrived to separate him from his sister and his friend Ross. Now, trying to tell herself that a walk through the wood to the lake was cooler than the tennis court, and that it was the only reason Ian and Jean had gone off on their own, Melinda waited for them to return. They had set out after lunch, talking companionably as they disappeared into the trees. They had also disappeared for a while after dinner the night before, and she'd found them in the gardens. Their voices low, their laughter intimate, their chairs drawn close. She had been fearful that he might propose them, but nothing had been said at breakfast, and Melinda had felt almost faint with relief. Perhaps Ian had planned to speak to Jean last evening, she thought, and for some reason changed his mind. Perhaps seeing so much of the girl had given him pause. He was an inspector, now at the Yard, well thought of, his career assured. Melinda had friends in high places, and when she met them in London for a luncheon or a dinner, they'd begun to mention Rutledge's prospects in their conversations. Of course, it wouldn't be surprising if he had begun to think of marriage. After all, he would soon be 25, and he could afford to keep a wife. But pray God, not Jean. Ian was a strong-minded man. He'd chosen to become a policeman rather than join the family firm of solicitors, which had set the cat amongst the pigeons. His father had not been happy with the decision. This was his only son, and he'd seen to his education with an eye to a future in law. But Ian had eventually won him over and joined the Metropolitan Police as a constable on the street. To no one's surprise in the family, he'd earned promotion after promotion on his own merit. Intelligent, with a quick wit and a sense of humour, he would have succeeded in whatever he'd wanted to do with his life. But Jean, who was noticeably ambitious, had astonished Melinda by commenting that she thought it rather fun to be acquainted with a policeman. As if this were a hobby that Rutledge would soon tire of and come to his senses. Melinda, knowing the man, knowing how he thought and felt, had nearly snapped that it was as unlikely to happen as it was to snow in London in July. But she'd bit her tongue in time. What was keeping them? Impatient, worried, she sat there facing the wood, watching for them, sending up a silent prayer that it would not be now, that there would still be time to introduce him to other, more suitable young women before he made his choice.
We've just heard A Fine Summer's Day by Charles Todd. A former career covert CIA operations officer, Valerie Plame Wilson worked to protect America's national security and prevent the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, in particular, nuclear weapons. Valerie is the author of the New York Times best-selling memoir, Fair Game, My Life as a Spy, My Betrayal by the White House, which was released as a motion picture of the same name, starring Sean Penn and Naomi Watts. She also narrated and appeared in a documentary on the dangers of nuclear proliferation, Countdown to Zero. She's an active member of the Global Zero Leadership Board. Valerie does extensive public speaking throughout the country on various issues, including nuclear proliferation and the role of women in intelligence. She's written for Newsweek, CNN, The Daily Beast, The Huffington Post, and other media outlets. She works as the Director of Community Outreach at the Santa Fe Institute, a nonprofit research think tank that promotes multidisciplinary collaboration in the sciences. She's also a consultant to Warner Brothers TV. Valerie has a bachelor's degree from Penn State and graduate degrees from the London School of Economics and the College of Europe in Bruges, Belgium. She now lives in Santa Fe, New Mexico, with her two children and her husband, retired U.S. Ambassador Joe Wilson, who has his own bestseller, The Politics of Truth. Today we'll speak with Valerie about her new fiction thriller, Burned. Welcome, Valerie, and thanks so much for joining us on the Book Report.
Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to talking with you.
After all you've endured, I would have thought writing about covert ops and the intelligence community would be the last thing you wanted to do. What made you pick up the pen and create Vanessa Pearson and Burned?
Well, I still find that whole world fascinating. If the leak of my name had not happened, I would be overseas right now, working for my government salary and working on these issues that I'm passionate about, making sure bad guys don't get nuclear weapons. But it didn't turn out that way, so maybe I'm living a little vicariously through my character, Vanessa Pearson. And she came about because I was so tired of how female CIA ops officers tend to be portrayed in popular culture, which is really just sort of arm candy, paper doll sort of thing. I wanted a realistic character that also entertained.
All right. Can you give us an overview of the story?
Well, in Burned, it starts off with, I don't want to give too much away, but it starts off with a suicide bomb in the courtyard of the Louvre. And that immediately Vanessa suspects that who's behind it is this nuclear black arms dealer, Boot, with whom she dealt with in the first book, Blowback, which came out about this time last year. And the CIA and the French intelligence service, since it happened on French soil, this initial attack, form a task force. And the story takes you to Amsterdam and Venice, Washington, London, and ends up in Istanbul, which is one of my favorite, most exotic cities in the world.
Mine too. Back to Boot. Is he a composite of people that you actually tried to track down?
Mm-hmm. To a certain extent, yes, but he was definitely inspired by the real-life Pakistani nuclear scientist A.Q. Khan, who for many, many years operated a worldwide network of, I like to think of it as nuclear entrepreneurship. If you had the money, he would sell it to you. And in fact, without Khan and his network, Iran would be a lot further behind in their desire for acquisition of a nuclear arsenal. He's now under some sort of a form of house arrest in Pakistan.
I see. With Blowback and now Burned, does the CIA have the authority to read your book and demand changes?
They do indeed. It's called the Publication Review Board. I signed a secrecy agreement when I joined the CIA, and I promised never to reveal classified information, sources, and methods. And in my memoir that came out in 2007, Fair Game, there was quite a bit that was redacted that had to do much less with any national security concerns and the fact that the agency made it clear that I was not to acknowledge any CIA affiliation prior to 2002. But with Blowback and with Burned, I submitted those manuscripts as well, and there were very few redactions. They understood that it was fiction.
Right. You and your husband were involved in a very complex situation that got lots of press attention. With several years past now, how would you want this part of your life to be remembered and recorded in the history books?
I think the takeaway lesson from what my husband and I went through would be how important it is for citizens to hold your government to account for their words and deeds. That's exactly what my husband did. I was, the betrayal of my CIA covert identity was a result of that. But as citizens, you don't just have rights, you have responsibilities. And one of them is to actively participate, I believe, in the democratic process. Be educated, know what the issues are, and be engaged at whatever level you choose, because that's the only way a healthy democracy can go forward and function.
So would you encourage your twins, for example, to work for the government?
I absolutely, they're in high school now, so who knows what they'll ultimately be drawn to, but I encourage them, and when I speak to university students, I always encourage those students to consider a career in public service. It doesn't have to be the CIA, but there's obviously so many challenges that we are facing, and we really do need the best and the brightest to go into public service and apply their talents there.
You work with Sarah Lovett on the thrillers. Describe the process of working together.
Yes, Sarah Lovett has been my co-author on both Blowback and now Burned. Our publisher put us together. She is an established thriller writer, and I like to think that we both bring our strengths to the table. She really has an understanding of the craft of writing and how you pace things so that it's exciting and you're turning the page. And, of course, what I hope to bring to it is my CIA experience, both in... Well, in everything, where the locales, the characters, the operations, how you recruit an asset, I wanted it to be as realistic as possible without, because so much of what is out there is very entertaining, but it really has nothing whatsoever to do with real-life intelligence collections.
We're speaking with Valerie Plame on The Book Report. You know, I'd love your opinion on something. North Korea is in the news so much lately. It seems that it's been a really tough nut to crack in terms of intelligence gathering. Why so?
Absolutely. Well, it's not called the Hermit Kingdom for nothing. It really is a, I think of it as a cult masquerading as a state. they have such highly centralized control and a paranoia, a xenophobia about the outside world, that it is not an open society where you can go in and make contacts and how you would typically recruit human sources within that milieu, within that society. Even in places in the world where we have serious, say, radical Islamic threats, you can still get, it's difficult, but you can still get in and move around that, about in that society by virtue of its location in the world, language, and the extremely controlling aspect of the central government. Very, you know, you don't just go in and go to the marketplace and start fitting in. That's near, that's impossible. And that's why human intelligence, at least on the North Korean nuclear program and whatever their plans are, is extremely difficult.
Okay. Talk about Global Zero and your work with Queen Noor, Naomi Watts, and others.
Yeah, it's something that I have found great satisfaction with. It's, in a way, a continuation of the work I did in the CIA, but obviously in a much more overt fashion. They are an international nonpartisan group dedicated to the proposition that we can have a world without nuclear weapons. Very serious people involved. As you mentioned, Queen Noor, we have Tony Blair, Mikhail Gorbachev, former Prime Minister, President of Pakistan, Musharraf, and James Baker, many others. All these people at that level have been very close to the notion, and some had their finger on the nuclear button when they were in power. And they realize that we simply have gotten lucky. Since the dawn of the nuclear age in New Mexico, we have come close dozens of times to inadvertent, accidental, mistaken, misinterpreted, very close calls to having a nuclear explosion. And we've just gotten lucky. And in fact, with the incredible rise of terrorism over the last 2 decades, really, as well as the spread of nuclear technology, unfortunately, we're in the position now where nuclear weapons make us all less safe, not more so.
And any final thoughts about the book?
Just that it's been great fun to do, and it's been well received, and I look forward to coming to Miami.
Yeah, it's. I know you'll be at the book fair. I look forward to meeting you there.
Oh, same to you. Right now, it's about 20 degrees in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Ooh.
So being in Miami for that alone will be a welcome.
Well, Valerie, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And now let's listen to a sampling of Burned, performed by Negin Farsad.
Here, the rain-slicked Cours Napoléon, the courtyard of the Louvre, stretched the 100 or so meters from the main Pi Pyramid to the Place du Carrousel. Vanessa slowed her pace so that she strolled toward the northwest corner of the pyramid, where it abutted a reflecting pond. The Arc de Triomphe stood clearly visible to the west beyond the metal crowd control barriers. She rummaged in her pockets, a tourist searching for her iPhone, for her camera, for a cigarette. She felt self-conscious, wanting to blend in, but her every nerve seemed to vibrate as she waited to make the meet. Her last meeting with an asset ended in disaster. He ended up dead. But I killed the Chechen. That nightmare is over, right? Her earpiece crackled. Got eyes on you, Hayes said. He had full audio contact with Vanessa and Jack, as well as feed from 2 exterior security cams. Copy that, Vanessa replied softly. She held up the phone, snapping a picture of the equestrian statue of King Louis XIV at the same time that she tracked the people around her. Even on a weekday mid-morning, the courtyard was crowded. A dozen Asians on a guided tour, rows of uniformed French schoolgirls walking in 2 lines, holding hands and scattered amid the tourists. A half dozen armed security officers dressed in black uniforms, police stenciled across their backs. For the past year, staff at some of the city's major landmarks had organized strikes to protest attacks by aggressive child pickpockets and beggars, the youngest members of criminal gangs flooding into Paris from Eastern European countries. Vanessa caught a glimpse of a compact, muscular man in a green slicker walking away from the pyramid. Jack. She registered her internal flicker of relief even as he disappeared amid a new stream of tourists flowing toward the pyramid. Damn it. Her reactions weren't back to normal. She was too on edge, spooked too easily. Come on, she told herself. The worst won't happen. This isn't last year. A group of young men and women approached in a cluster. She counted 8 males and 3 females, all attractive, olive-skinned, dark-featured. Not one of them was her Syrian asset, Farid Hasser, with his amber eyes and shy smile. Arabs? Hayes asked, clearly catching a visual of them from the security feed. For an instant, Vanessa thought so, then not. She thought she heard Hebrew. Negative, she said under her breath. She checked her watch. 10:51 hours, 9 minutes before their agreed-upon meeting. Her Nicorette gum tasted stale in her mouth. Not surprising, after nearly 3 hours of SDR surveillance detection route to make certain she hadn't been followed. Farid's intel was bringing him out of the shadows, and that was always a risk. When he made contact via coded email, he alluded to a problem with the newest product you are interested in. I think some things are wrong in the distribution process. That message, coupled with rumors in the world of counterproliferation and the bits and pieces of intel from CIA and NSA analysts, made Vanessa and her cohorts at CPD all but certain that Farid's product was a miniaturized nuclear weapon, a prototype smuggled out of Boots' Iranian underground production facility just weeks before U.S. bombers destroyed it last September. But the most ominous implication of Farid's message, some things are wrong in the distribution process, convinced Vanessa that the smuggled nuke might already be in the hands of a third-party buyer. Her tiny earpiece vibrated again when Hayes said, "Male, early 20s, dark hair, dark blue parka, you're 1 o'clock.
We've just heard Burned by Valerie Plame with Sarah Lovett. In C.S. Harris's Why Kings Confess, the gruesome murder of a young French physician draws investigator Sebastian Sincere and his pregnant wife into a dangerous, decades-old mystery. In January 1813, a badly injured Frenchwoman is found beside the mutilated body of Dr. Damien Pelletan. Sebastian finds himself caught in a high-stakes tangle of murder and revenge. Although the woman has no memory of the attack, Sebastian knows her from an incident in his past, an act of wartime brutality that nearly destroyed him. As the search for the killer leads Sebastian into a treacherous web of duplicity, he discovers that Pelletan was part of a secret delegation sent by Napoleon to investigate the possibility of peace with Britain. Despite his powerful father-in-law's warnings, Sebastian plunges deep into the mystery of the boy prince who disappeared in the darkest days of the French Revolution. He soon finds himself at lethal odds with the ruthless daughter of Marie Antoinette. Davina Porter narrates.
Paul Gibson lurched down the dark, narrow lane, his face raw from the cold, his fingers numb. There were times when he wandered these alleyways lost in brightly hued reveries of opium-induced euphoria, but not tonight. Tonight, Gibson clenched his jaw and tried to focus on the tap-tap of his wooden leg on the icy cobbles, the reedy wail of a babe carried on the night wind, anything that might distract his mind from the restless, hungering need that drenched his thin frame with sweat and tormented him with ghosts of what could be. When he first noticed the woman, he thought her an apparition, a mirage of grey wool and velvet lying crumpled beside the entrance to a fetid passageway. But as he drew nearer, he saw a pale flesh and the gleaming dark wetness of blood, and knew that she was only too real. He drew up sharply, the dank, briny air of the nearby Thames rasping in his throat. Cat's Hole, they called this narrow lane, a refuge for thieves, prostitutes, and all the desperate dispossessed of England and beyond. He could feel his heart pounding. The stars glittered like shards of broken glass in the thin slice of cold black sky visible between the looming rooftops above. He hesitated, perhaps longer than he should have. But he was a surgeon, his life dedicated to the care of others. He pushed himself forward again. She lay curled half on her side, one hand flung out, palm up, eyes closed. He hunkered down awkwardly beside her, fingertips searching for a pulse in her slim neck. Her face was delicately boned and framed by a riot of long, flame-red hair, her lashes dark and thick against the pale flesh of her smooth cheeks, her lips purple-blue with cold. Or death. But at his touch, her eyelids fluttered open, her chest jerking on a sob, and a broken, whispered prayer. Santa Marie, Mère de Dieu, priez pour nous pauvres pécheurs. It's all right. I'm here to help you, he said gently, wondering whether she could even understand him. Where are you hurt? The entire side of her head, he now saw, was matted with blood. Wide-eyed and frightened, she fixed her gaze on him. Then her focus shifted to where the black mouth of the passage yawned beside them. Damn you! Her hand jerked up to clutch his sleeve. Is he all right? Gibson followed her gaze. The man's body was more difficult to discern, a dark, motionless mass deep in the shadows. Gibson shook his head. I don't know. Her grip on his arm twisted convulsively. Go to him, please. Nodding, Gibson surged upright, staggering slightly as his wooden peg took his weight and the phantom pains of a long-gone limb ripped through him. The passage reeked of rot and excrement and the familiar coppery stench of spilled blood. The man lay sprawled on his back beside a pile of broken hogsheads and crates. It was with difficulty that Gibson picked out the once snowy white folds of a cravat, the silken sheen of what had been a fine waistcoat, but was now a blood-soaked mess, horribly ripped. Tell me, said the woman. Tell me he lives. But Gibson could only stare at the body before him. The man's eyes were wide and sightless, his handsome young face pallid, his outflung arms stiffening in the cold.
That was Why Kings Confess by C.S. Harris. In 1965, five teenage friends fled Glasgow for London to pursue their dream of musical stardom. Yet before year's end, three had returned, and returned damaged. In 2015, a brutal murder forces the three men, now in their 60s, to journey back to London and finally confront the dark truth they've run from for five decades. Peter May's Runaway covers 50 years of friendships solidified and severed, dreams shared and shattered, and passions lit and extinguished. Peter Forbes performs the tale.
Slowly his killer releases his lifeless form to fall back on the bed, frail with age, but heavier now in death. The click in the dark seems deafening, and the light that falls upon the bed, like the dead man, almost shocking. Hands in latex gloves untie a canvas roll and open it out on still warm sheets. Light reflects on a choice of five glinting sterile scalpels. Simon's nightshirt is rolled back from his left forearm, and one of the scalpels is selected, all performed with the unerring certainty of a man who knows he has all the time in the world for this. Carefully, and with a well-honed and dexterous skill, the killer starts to cut away the skin of the forearm, effectively flaying it. There is very little blood to stain the bed, for the heart has long since given up any attempt at pumping it around Simon's rapidly cooling body. 2015. Chapter 1. Glasgow. 1. Jack stepped down from the bus almost at the end of Battlefield Road and raised his head towards the darkening sky with a sense of foreboding. He took in the brooding silhouette of the smoke-stained Victoria Infirmary that climbed the hill above the field of battle where Mary, Queen of Scots, was once defeated by James VI, and felt as if someone had just walked over his grave. He knew, in truth, that he no longer needed his stick. Most of his strength had returned, and the prognosis following his minor myocardial infarction was good. The diet they put him on had successfully lowered his cholesterol, and the daily walking, they said, would do him more good than an hour in the gym. Still, he had grown to depend upon it, like an old friend. He enjoyed the feel of the brass owl curled into the palm of his hand, steadying, reliable, unchanging, unlike everything else around him. Gone was the old Queen's Park School, abandoned, then damaged by fire, and finally demolished. The Battlefield Rest, with its green and cream tiles and clock tower, once a news kiosk and waiting room for city trams, now an Italian restaurant. The red sandstone Langside Library was still there, a final gift from Carnegie, but the infirmary itself, filled for Jack with both formative and final memories, was due for closure, its functions to be replaced by the new Southern General. His tonsils and adenoids had been removed here as a child. He could still remember the smell of rubber as they put the mask over his face to send him to sleep in the operating theatre, and the line of light beneath the door of his two-bed ward that night, mysterious shadows passing back and forth in the corridor beyond, like dark demons stalking his young imagination. But as he stepped into the shabby, green-painted foyer and breathed in that depressing, antiseptic hospital smell, the memory that almost overwhelmed him was of the death of his mother. Those dark winter evenings he had spent at her bedside, finding her sometimes distressed, at other times almost comatose, and once lying in her own filth. And then, finally, the night he had arrived to find her bed empty. Moved, the ward sister told him, to another building. It had taken him some time to find her, and when he did, he felt as if he had stepped onto a stage set for some dreadful denouement. A cavernous Victorian ward, chaotic in its arrangement of beds and screens, light in pools barely permeating the darkness. She had gripped his hand, scared by the moans and occasional cries of unseen patients, and whispered, "They've brought me here to die." And then, "I don't want to go alone."
That was a sampling of Runaway by Peter May. May I introduce you to Department Q and Jussi Adler-Olsen, one of Denmark's premier crime writers. His books routinely top European bestseller lists, and he's won nearly every Nordic crime writing award, including the prestigious Glass Key, also won by Stieg Larsson and Joe Nesbø. In A Conspiracy of Faith, book 3 in the series, Detective Carl Mork has received a bottle that holds an old and decayed message written in blood. It's a cry for help from two young brothers, tied and bound in a boathouse by the sea. After floating in the ocean for years before turning up, the bottle sat forgotten, unopened, on a police department windowsill, before the seal was cracked and the gruesome message written in Danish was analyzed. Could it be real? Who were those boys and why weren't they reported missing? Could they possibly still be alive? Graham Malcolm narrates.
It was the third morning, and the smell of tar and seaweed had got into his clothes. Under the boathouse floor, the mush of ice lapped soundlessly against the wooden stilts and awakened memories of days when everything had been all right. He lifted his upper body from the bedding of waste paper and pulled himself sufficiently upright to make out his younger brother's face, which, even in sleep, seemed tormented, chilled to the bone. Soon he would wake and glance around in panic. He would feel the leather straps tight on his wrists and waist and hear the jangle of the chain that constrained him. He would see the snowstorm and the light as it struggled to penetrate the tarred timber planks. And then he would start to pray. Countless times he'd seen desperation in his brother's eyes. Through the gaffer tape that covered his mouth came the repeated sound of his muffled pleas that Jehovah have mercy upon them. Yet both of them knew that Jehovah no longer paid heed, for blood had passed their lips. Blood that their jailer had let drip into their cups, the cups from which he had allowed them to drink before revealing to them what they had contained. They had drunk water, but in the water was blood, so forbidden, and now they were damned forever. And for that reason, shame pierced deeper even than thirst. "What do you think he'll do to us?" his brother's frightened eyes seemed to ask. But how could he ever know the answer? All he knew, instinctively, was that it would all soon be over. He leaned back and scanned the room once again in the dim light, allowing his gaze to pass across the collar beams and through the formations of cobwebs, noting each and every projection, each and every knot. The worn paddles and oars that hung from the apex of the ceiling, the rotten fishing nets that had long since made their last catch. And then he discovered the bottle. A gleam of sunlight played momentarily on the blue-white glass to dazzle him. So near and yet so hard to reach, it was just behind him, wedged between the thick, rough-hewn planks of the floor. He stuck his fingers through the gap and tried to prise the bottle upward by the neck, but the air froze upon his skin. When the thing came loose, he would smash it, and used the shards to cut through the strap that kept his hands tied tight together behind his back. And when it succumbed, his numb fingers would find the buckle at his spine. He would loosen it, tear the tape from his mouth, remove the straps from around his waist and thighs, and as soon as the chain that was fastened to the leather strap at his waist no longer held him back, he would lunge forward and free his brother. He would draw him toward him and hold him tight until their bodies ceased to tremble. Then, he imagined, he would use all his strength to gouge into the timber around the door with the broken glass. He would see if he could hollow out the planks to which the hinges were fixed. And if the worst should happen, and the car came before he was finished, he would lie in wait for the man. He would stand poised behind the door with the broken glass in his hand. That was what he told himself he would do. He leaned forward, folded his freezing fingers behind his back, and prayed for forgiveness for his wicked thought. Then he scraped again in the space between the planks to try to free the bottle. He scraped and scratched until the neck angled enough for him to grab hold of it. He listened. Was that an engine? Yes, it was. The powerful engine of a large car. But was it approaching or simply passing by in the distance out there? For a moment, the low, deep sound seemed to get louder. He began to pull so desperately at the neck of the bottle that his knuckles cracked audibly. But then the sound died away. Had it been the wind turbines rumbling and whirring? Maybe it was something else entirely. He had no idea. He expelled warm breath from his nostrils. It steamed the air around his face. He wasn't so afraid anymore, not now. As long as he thought about the grace of Jehovah, he felt better. He pressed his lips together and labored on, and when finally the bottle came free, he struck it so hard against the timber of the floor that his brother lifted his head with a startled jolt and looked around in terror. Again and again he brought the bottle down against the floor. It was hard to get purchase with his hands behind his back. Too hard.
That was A Conspiracy of Faith by UC Adler Olson. And now, meet the writer who's being called the Queen of Danish Crime, Sarah Bladel. She's sold nearly 2 million copies of her 9 bestsellers, and her latest publishing deal is the largest in Danish history. In her new title, The Forgotten Girls, the body of an unidentified woman is discovered in a local forest. A large, unique scar on one side of her face should make the ID easy, but nobody has reported her missing. As the new commander of the Missing Persons Department, Louise Rick involves the media by releasing a photo of the victim, hoping to find someone who knew her. Louise's gamble pays off. An older woman phones to say she recognizes the woman as Lizimet, a child she once cared for in the state mental institution. Lizimet, like the other children in the institution, was abandoned by her family and branded a forgotten girl. But Louise soon discovers something more disturbing. Lizimet had a twin, and both girls were issued death certificates more than 30 years ago. Aided by her friend, journalist Camilla Lind, Louise finds the investigation takes a surprising turn when it brings her closer to her childhood home. As she uncovers more crimes that were committed and hidden in the forest, she's forced to confront a terrible link to her own past. Christine Lakin narrates.
The homicide room was at the end of the hallway. This rearmost autopsy room was twice the size of the other bays to allow room for police and forensic officers, but the room was set up the same as the others, with a steel table, a wide sink, and bright lamps. Louise took out her dictaphone and placed it where it could record Fleming's examination of the body. The entire process was photographed by Osir, who was compiling the materials for investigation at the Center of Forensic Services. The samples that Fleming collected in the process would be passed on to the forensic geneticists upstairs. While Louise wouldn't exactly say the woman lying on the table in the middle of the room was dirty, neither would she say she was well-groomed. Her hair was overgrown and tangled, and her nails long and jagged. Most striking was the large scar that covered one cheek and pulled down the eye a little, giving her face a sad expression.
The dentist was astounded, to put it mildly, when he finished his examination,
Osir said as she lifted her camera.
He said it's extremely rare for him to see a set of teeth in such a state of neglect. They're ruined from cavities and very crooked.
Fleming nodded.
She has apparently never had any kind of orthodontics, and there's severe periodontal disease in the upper part of the mouth, he said. She already lost several teeth.
Louise grabbed a tall stool, which she moved closer as Fleming started the internal examination. The organs had been removed and transferred to a steel tray next to the sink.
We're dealing with a full-grown woman, but I'm having difficulty assessing her age.
He bent over the body.
As far as the distinctive scar is concerned, I feel certain that it has never been treated. It's a violent injury from some time back. It may also have been a corrosive burn, he added pensively. There hasn't been any grafting, and it must have hurt like hell when it happened.
Louise nodded. That had been her initial thought as well.
She also has an old scar that could easily date all the way back to her childhood. At one point in time, she broke a bone in her left forearm, which wasn't treated.
The medical examiner looked up at them as he drew his first conclusion.
All of this tells me that she has been profoundly neglected throughout her life, and that she was probably quite isolated.
Louise looked at the ruined soles of the woman's feet and the cuts on her ankles. They clearly showed that she had gone barefoot for a long way. Fleming turned his eyes back to the woman's body once more and continued the autopsy in silence for a short while, until he noted that in falling down the slope, the deceased had broken 7 ribs on her left side.
There's about 5 pints of blood in the left pulmonary cavity, he announced without looking up. And the lung is collapsed.
After rinsing the internal organs and examining them one by one, he straightened up and told Osir that he was finished.
Aside from the broken ribs and the blood in the pulmonary cavity, there's no indication of violence, he said, rolling off his skin-tight gloves and throwing them in the trash. My immediate guess would be that she died of her internal bleeding.
He paused and thought for a moment before adding,
One detail that may be of interest is that I'm quite convinced the woman had intercourse shortly before her death. But I need to get that confirmed, of course, so I'll have to wait to get the test results back before I can say for certain. That could take about a week.
She nodded. It very well could, when there was no indication that the death was the result of a crime. She got up and walked back to look at the woman's disfigured face. If I'm right, it could mean that perhaps she wasn't that lonely after all. Fleming walked over to call the technicians, letting them know he had finished. But still lonely enough that no one has found reason to report her missing, despite the fact that she's been dead almost a week, Louise said.
That was a sampling of The Forgotten Girls by Sarah Bladel. Stuart Neville, a master of neo-noir detective fiction, is back with a chilling new thriller, The Final Silence. The title has the distinction of being nominated for an Edgar, the top award from the Mystery Writers of America. Belfast, Northern Ireland. Rhea Carlisle has inherited a house from an uncle she never knew. It doesn't take her long to clear out the dead man's remaining possessions, but one room remains stubbornly locked. When Rhea forces it open, she discovers inside a chair, a table, and a leather-bound book, its pages filled with locks of hair, fingernails, and a catalog of victims. Horrified, Rhea wants to go straight to the police, but her family intervenes, fearing scandal. Rhea turns to the only person she can think of, disgraced police inspector Jack Lennon. Not only is he facing suspension from the force, but his new supervisor, DCI Serena Flanagan, is the toughest cop he's ever met. Then, a gruesome murder brings the dead man's terrifying journal to the top of the Belfast police priority list. Gerard Doyle narrates.
Raymond Drew wanted to die on the towpath. Even if there was no sun, no blue sky to die beneath, he wanted it to be by the river. He didn't care if the ground was sodden with rainfall as he collapsed. If he could manage it, he'd fall dead into the water. At least that way he could be sure. To survive and be brought to a hospital was unthinkable. They would contact his family, such as it was, and his sister Ida would go to his house, and the things she would find there. He should have destroyed them, but he couldn't. He was not strong enough to take that action and endure the consequences. It would be easier simply to die. At least if he was gone, he would not have to face that terrible discovery. The real Raymond Drew, the creature that had hidden beneath this human skin for more than 6 decades, would be revealed. Raymond locked the front door of his house, the 3-bedroom semi on Derrimore Gardens he'd lived in for 30 years. Just one of many identical structures on this street, red brick, early 1900s, the kind of houses that middle-class couples and property developers were falling over themselves to buy until the financial crisis. Raymond had shared the first 2 years here with a wife he'd barely known, let alone loved. Dead and buried now, and he hadn't missed her for a moment. He tucked the keys into his pocket. The grass of his lawn looked like stubble on a drunkard's chin. He hadn't cut it in years. The man next door, Hughes his name was, gave up asking Raymond to mow it and did it himself every few weeks. The spring would soon start it growing again. Not that it mattered to Raymond anymore. He left his car on the driveway, closed the gate behind him, and walked. The Vauxhall Corsa didn't have an MOT or tax. It hadn't been driven in months. A few minutes took him down the shallow incline of Sunnyside Street, past the corner shops and Chinese takeaways, to Annadale Embankment. He avoided eye contact with students and housewives on the way. At the bridge by the river, he waited at the pedestrian crossing for the green man to appear and tell him to go. Like a good boy. Raymond had learned to be a good boy long ago, to be quiet, respectful, obey all rules while outside his home. Not to draw attention. Once across the dark, slow-moving water to the Stranmiller side, he walked south along the river's edge, beneath the bony branches of the still winterbare trees. Past the newly rebuilt Lyric Theatre, on further, the blocks of apartments with their waterside views. Traffic rumbled to his right, cars, vans and lorries filtering in and out of the city, heading north or east. that sickly swelling in his chest, pulsing, robbing him of breath. He did not slow his pace, even as the sweat dripped from his eyebrows. Cold on his back, running down his spine. Raymond had gone to the doctor 2 months before. A soft-spoken and serious young woman, she had talked about medication, pills, things to ease the tired muscle in his breast. She talked about more tests, bloods, wires tethered to his skin, a specialist at the Royal Victoria Hospital. It was serious, the young doctor had said. It was only a matter of time before an attack came, perhaps a big one. Appointments were made, a prescription printed on patterned paper. Raymond did not keep the appointments, nor did he have the prescription filled. He simply wanted to know. It had been a month since the fluttering in his chest had intensified. Then the dizzy spells, the cold sweats, the feeling of his torso being crushed by some invisible hand. He awoke throughout the night, gasping, wild horses galloping inside his ribcage. Only a matter of time. A cool wave washed across his brow, and his legs weakened. He gripped the railing to steady himself, waited while the blood coursed through his body. A pub just ahead, perched on the riverbank, tables and benches and umbrellas, damp and pathetic in the grey. A drink. Just one last swallow to see it done. Raymond entered the pub.
That was The Final Silence by Stuart Neville. Readers, I hope you'll agree the Ides of March is the perfect time to sample top international thriller writers. These talented authors know how to grip you from the start and keep you turning those pages. There are so many big titles coming out this spring. Be sure to keep current by checking my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.